My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. Jeff Lerner, your host, always so excited to be back with you, having amazing conversations with amazing human beings. So far, that's all we've had on the show are human beings. I don't know. Maybe we'll have to expand that intro someday. But for today, phenomenal human being, Tom Wheelwright, who's a CPA. I have known of Tom, gosh, probably 20 plus years because I was introduced to him. He was one of, or presume maybe still is, I actually, he'll tell us, one of the advisors in the Rich Dad coterie of the Robert Kiyosaki universe. Back when I first read Rich Dad, Poor Dad in the late 90s, Tom was one of the senior people in that world. But he's a luminary, independent of that. I'm actually going to introduce him by reading two statements off his website, which not only I think serve as an introduction, but actually as a basis for what I hope we can talk about for most of the next hour. On his website, it says, "The truth about taxes. The tax law is a roadmap to financial freedom filled with incentives for entrepreneurs and investors. You just have to follow the rules of the rich." So basically we're saying the tax law can be, because you know, there's so many people that are like, well, I want this outcome, but how do I get there? What's the long and winding path to get to the wealthy outcome? You're saying the tax law actually it holds the clues to that. So very excited to dig into that. And then he talks about wealth through taxes. It says here, taxes are looked at so negatively by most people, but taxation is actually one of the most powerful tools for wealth creation. Having said that, I'm hooked. I'm sure the audience is hooked. Tom, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Jeff. Really, really fun to be on your show.
No, I'm glad you're here. If you're seeing this on YouTube, you're immediately noticing a vending machine and a security line in my background. So I am broadcasting from an airport. I'm in the middle of some travel. So apologies in advance if, you know, they announce a flight over the loudspeaker. We'll just have to fight through it. But Tom, grateful to have you here. We can really start where you think it's germane to start. I'd love to go back at least to when I first encountered you in the late 90s, early 2000s, kind of the Rich Dad circle days. But even before that, I mean, I remember the way the Robert Kiyosaki books presented you to the audience as sort of this, almost like a maverick, a guy with a very different, very entrepreneurial take on taxes and accounting. So maybe even ramp us into that of how you became that guy, and then we can go from there.
Well, I've always been a fan of entrepreneurs. And I'm the son, grandson, and great-grandson of entrepreneurs. So it is literally in my DNA. And so I actually went through, you know, I did the traditional. I have a master's of tax. I have a 7 years with Ernst & Young. I had 4 years in a Fortune 1000 company as in-house tax advisor. When I started my firm, I decided to start a firm that was very focused on tax planning for entrepreneurs. And because there wasn't one. At the time, this was in the 90s, and there was no such thing as a tax planning firm for entrepreneurs. There was the big four, they did tax planning, and then there were a lot of middle market firms, and they do primarily tax returns. They're not really planners. And then small firms that do tax returns. So every once in a while, you'd find a really good tax planner, but it's pretty rare. So when I initially started tax planning, I'm going,
actually,
okay.
Can I interject?
Yeah.
And even have you double click on the idea of a tax planner versus a tax preparer?
Yeah. So the question is, are you looking backwards or forwards? Right. I look at an entrepreneur, entrepreneurs look forwards, right? We don't tend to look backwards a lot. We probably should look backwards a little bit more than we do. But we tend to always have our eye on what's next. What do we do next? How do we make it better in the future? And a tax planner, that's what they do, right? And then I met Robert in 2001. And when I met Robert, he started to have an impact, just like he did on you and millions of other people, just in the way I'm starting to think, right? And I started looking at the tax law differently. Then I stopped looking at pension plans and IRAs and 401ks as the way to plan. I had a client early in my original firm that I started that was complaining to me because he paid so much tax with me, but he didn't pay tax with his previous CPA. And I said, well, your situation's changed. Before, you were a business owner and you were getting all these deductions. You were putting all this money in your pension plan. Now you're taking all the money out of the pension plan and you have no more deductions. I'm going, that's what happened. And it kind of struck me that, wait a minute, you know, there's a lot of things other than pension plans that are really good in the tax law. And what I soon realized was how much of the tax law is really about permanent tax savings, not temporary tax savings. I actually was at a conference in New York, Manhattan. Ironically, it was a marketing conference for CPAs, which sounds like an oxymoron. But I was talking to, we had a cocktail hour and I just asked people around me. I said, so how much of your tax planning is deferral, postponing taxes in the future? And on average, the answer was 95 to 100%. And I'm going, that doesn't make sense, because if I take an expense that's not deductible and I make it deductible, that's permanent. That's not deferral. That's not postponing it. If I get a tax credit, that's permanent. That's not deferral. If I do even depreciation, which is starts out as deferral, I can make it permanent. You know, so there are, it just hit me pretty hard, particularly when 2008 rolled around. 2008 rolled around and we had the we had the Great Recession, right? 2008, 9, 10. And we had all this stimulus going to the banks and industry and so forth. And what kind of struck me was, well, wait a minute, that's all the tax law is. It's just a series of stimulus packages, whether it's Ronald Reagan's stimulus for depreciation for real estate, or whether it was John F. Kennedy's stimulus for manufacturing, or some of Bill Clinton's stimulus for homeowners, right? They're all stimulus packages. And so I decided, well, you know what? Robert asked me to write a book. And I thought, well, this is how I should write the book, because I believe that the tax law actually is not that complicated, as long as you stick with the concepts, not the details. And I believe that it can be fun. It's actually a game. We're all in the game. We just have to decide, are we going to win the game, lose the game? You know, are we going to be passive in the game? Or are we going to be active in the game? And I love games. I grew up loving games. I've always been competitive in sports and other types of games. And I'm going, this is a fun game. This is a really fun game. And I wasn't afraid of it, because I had, my mentors had been the best, literally the best tax professionals in the world. I was in the National Tax Office of Ernst & Young. And so I have all this, you know, I had all these great mentors, all this great experience. I went to the best tax school in the country, University of Texas. And so it just didn't faze me. I'm going, this is just fun. That's all it is. And so let's make it fun. And that's why I like to say that my mission is make taxes fun, easy, and understandable, because I think that taxes don't have to be scary. The tax law fundamentally is a series of incentives. That's what it is. And if you look at the type of incentives, Jeff, what I love about these incentives is that they make sense from an investment standpoint. They don't just make sense from a tax standpoint. They actually work both ways. And that's kind of what hit me. So for example, let me give you a very simple example. So I was mentioning earlier about making an expense deductible. Well, there's four requirements. It has to have a business purpose. It needs to be ordinary, meaning typical in your business. It needs to be necessary, meaning it creates a profit, and it needs to be well documented. Well, if you think about those four criteria, if every entrepreneur listening used those four criteria for every expense, they would make a lot more money, because they would not waste money. Yeah. Those requirements require you to actually do something that has a true intention of a profit motive, that actually gets well documented, that's well noted, that's well thought out. And it's not just haphazard. So that was kind of the first clue to me when I really looked at the rules when I was writing Tax-Free Wealth, and I really looked at the rules for deduction. It came down to those four things. I'm going, well, wait a minute. Those are the requirements for a legitimate business expense that actually makes sense to spend money.
Can you say the four criteria again?
Okay, so it has to have a business purpose. That one's easy, right? Yeah. It just has some business purpose. It needs to be ordinary, meaning that it's typical. So this means that you don't go out and do, you know, odd things. For example, you don't go and spend $3,000 on a bottle of wine for a customer that pays you $500 a year, right? That would not be ordinary or typical, right? And it's not a good business expense, frankly.
Can I ask a question about it? Yeah. A clarifying question. Ordinary can still mean a one-time expense if it's of an ordinary nature. Like, for example, if I were to invest in a class to learn a skill in the context of my trade so that I could increase my prices.
Absolutely. That would be ordinary. That would be typical. Okay. That would be typical. It could be one time. It could be multiple times. It doesn't matter. I mean, you could have a big marketing expense. Let's say you decide to put on a seminar, right? Yeah. And you go, I'm going to have this huge expense for the seminar, but my intent is I'm going to produce so much revenue because I'm going to generate new customers and sell a lot of products at the event that therefore it's worth that one time, you know, $100,000 expenditure, for example. Mm-hmm. That's a good point, is that it can be a one-time expense. It just has to be typical in your business. So it'd be typical to spend $100,000. I mean, if you can do a conference on a $100,000 budget, you're doing really well, right? A lot of them are upwards of $1 million. So that would be typical. The third question is it necessary? And necessary means it's either going to build my market share or it's going to create profit for me. That's the intent. One of those two things. So it can't be something that's casual. It can't be something that, oh, this would be nice, right? But it's more personal. I mean, let's say, for example, let's take travel, for example. All right. So if I go and I travel, I'm going, you know, it might be nice to, you know, look at some real estate, even though I'm not really, you know, going to New York to look at real estate. I'm going to go look at real estate. Well, does that make sense? No, you wouldn't spend that money. You wouldn't go to New York for that unless you really were interested in New York real estate and you really thought that was a good market for you.
Can we use that hypothetical to say, okay, so let's say I spend $5,000 on a 3-day weekend trip to New York. Mm-hmm. I stay in a nice hotel. I go out to eat a few times. I mean, you can spend $5,000 in New York pretty fast. But at one point I take an Uber ride out to Long Island to look at a piece of property and then back. It would perhaps be reasonable to deduct the cost of the Uber ride back and forth. Right. That was directly attached to the real estate, but it would not be reasonable to deduct the whole trip to New York.
It, exactly. On the other hand, let's say that you left on, here's one you can do. Let's say you left on Thursday, you get there Friday, you spend all day Friday looking at real estate and you're very interested in buying real estate. And then you goof off all weekend. And then on Monday, you spend all day looking at real estate and Tuesday, you fly back home. That's mm-hmm. actually fully deductible. The whole weekend's deductible. Okay. Because you are there to do business during the work days. The fact that you are there over a weekend in order to do that business is not relevant actually to the conversation. But it would even be better if you could say, well, look, I had a conference that went Friday, Saturday. You know, took it easy on Sunday, Monday, I went and looked at real estate, et cetera. So my point is that these are things that they're good business practices. That's my point
So I feel like you've just given us already a hack, which is if you're taking a business trip, span it across a weekend.
For sure.
Because then whatever's happening on the weekend can be attributed to just, well, that's just a function of the business cycle.
That's just because I'm there.
Yeah. Okay. Super cool. Okay. Thank you. I mean, you literally just changed my way. Cause I'm like, it's a Wednesday. I'm in the airport right now flying to Denver for a conference. Tomorrow's setup. It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday conference. Monday I fly home. There's even a dinner on a Saturday night. I can say, well, I had to eat and I was there for a conference.
For sure. Okay. That's travel away from home. That's for sure. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. You just save me a few bucks. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. But that's a legitimate expense for your business anyway. I mean, you think about it, it's good for you to be at that conference. You're making money at that conference. And so, yes, you have to eat, even if you decide to eat by yourself, or, you know, you took your spouse out for dinner or whatever, you have to eat. So it's,
can I ask another, I hope you don't mind. I told you I was inviting you to come on for a podcast conversation. And I didn't tell you is I was just going to get an hour of free tax consulting, but, hopefully it's for the audience too. But no, in all seriousness, I'm like some of these, you know, the devil's in the details. I hope you don't mind if I interrupt and ask a little clarifying questions. When you talk about it being necessary or essential, or, you know, essentially attached to profit, would it be fair to substitute maybe attached to value? And I think a lot in terms of, because I teach entrepreneurship, so I think a lot of in terms of the underlying principles, where that, like, the creation of value for a customer now, if there's actually a theory that would say the longer you delay the realization of the profit from that value creation, the more profit there will ultimately be to realize, because there's more goodwill that can build over time. So if I want to invest money now in something that isn't monetized, isn't sold, but that's solely about creating more value for the customer. Yeah. And in my mind, I know that, like, thinking like Amazon thinks of in these long flywheel cycles that, hey, 2 years from now, there's going to be more to realize as a result of this. That's still legitimately deductible, even if I'm not realizing profit.
Yeah, for sure. Let me give you an example. So during the pandemic, we had the PPP loans, right?
Yeah, right.
And this is a huge thing. We had a number of clients that were in our CPA firm that were really struggling. They were, am I going to stay in business, et cetera. They needed those PPP loans. They really needed them. We made a decision, my partner and I at our CPA firm, we were not going to charge for that. We were going to spend the time, spend the money. We're going to get the people. We're going to get those PPP loans for our clients, because that means the clients are going to be more successful. We're going to bank that. We made no profit during 2020. Our profit was zero for 2020 because we spent so much time doing things for the clients to keep them in business. And to me, that was well worth that expenditure of what would otherwise be profit, right? And expending that on the clients so that you got that long-term client. And not only that, but you just go, okay, sometimes you just need to take care of your clients.
And you obviously were able to deduct all those costs associated.
Right, of course.
And you didn't, in so doing, you didn't like increase your audit risk or raise a flag to the IRS to say, wait, you invested, you have these expenses, but I don't know how maybe smart and or scrutinous the IRS is to say, but, you know, do we understand the long game that all you're really trying to do is create value you can realize over.
Their analysis isn't quite that detailed. They're looking at well, is this a typical business expense? And all of ours were. I mean, most of it was paying wages and salaries, right? We didn't lay anybody off. We actually hired people. So that's really what it was. And the IRS, they're more concerned about, are you doing something because it's really a personal expense that you just threw into your business? And I can't tell you, Jeff, how many people do that. They cheat on their taxes. They think that's the only way to reduce their taxes. And the whole point of what I do for a living and teaching tax-free wealth and win-win wealth strategy is that you don't have to cheat. In fact, I know a lot of very wealthy people, as you do, and I don't know any of them that cheat on their taxes, because they don't have to, because they have tax advisors who understand the law well enough that they can do those things that are all legitimate expenditures. They're all legitimate things to do, legitimate investments, and reduce their taxes that way. You know, like Robert Kiyosaki, you mentioned him. I still meet with him weekly, and he always teases his buddy. He's got a buddy who lives in Puerto Rico, because Puerto Rico, of course, only has a 4% tax. Mm-hmm. And he goes, why would you live in Puerto Rico? You could live here and still pay no tax. And he's right. He says, but the difference is that it's kind of being lazy to live in Puerto Rico to pay a 4% tax. If you live in the US to pay a small amount of tax, you have to be a truly active investor and truly active in your wealth creation.
Gotcha. Okay, that's interesting. So I want to make sure we close the loop you were restating the four criteria and we got through the first three. What was the fourth?
So last one's documentation. And this is if you get audited, the very first thing the IRS is going to ask you for is documentation of your expenses. And by the way, credit card receipts do not count. Credit card statements do not count. Okay. You have to have the actual receipt. So you scan the receipt. You have to, put, if it's a meal, you have to put actually who you were with, what you were talking about.
So the reason is because you're actually meant to put more detail than, I actually will own, I have in the past just used credit card statements.
Right. And the IRS audited,
but I've assumed that
would work. Yeah, they won't accept that on audit. They won't accept that as a receipt. Okay. So know that. That doesn't mean they will always ask for all they won't ask for all your receipts ever. Okay. But they will typically do a sample and say, okay, tell me what this is. Show me, show me your general. I mean, if you're in business, it's going to be your general ledger. You know, it's going to be really more of did you really spend the money type of a thing. But the point is that if you, I always like to say, if you pretend to document it, you get a pretend deduction. So you have to actually document it to get an actual deduction. They will disallow it. That's the first thing they do. They will absolutely disallow if you don't have the receipts.
Okay. Thank you. You said something earlier that I'd like us to go back to. You said the tax law is pretty simple if you stick to the principles and not the details.
Right.
That seems like a great place to go for the audience here. Can you dig into the simple, let's call them simple underlying principles that everyone needs to understand? And then, we can always layer the details on top of them.
Sure. Let's start with the most basic of basics. There is one line in the Internal Revenue Code that says all income is taxable unless we say it isn't. So as a general rule, all income is taxable. That means that if you get paid cash, it's still taxable. if you get paid in a trade, it's still taxable. All income is taxable. That is rule number one. That's rule number one in the Internal Revenue Code. Rule number two is nothing is deductible unless we say it is. So you'll hear, Jeff, people say, why am I having to prove why am I have to prove that I'm right? Why doesn't the IRS have to prove it, right? Why am I guilty until proven innocent? It's because you have to prove that your deduction meets the exception to the law that nothing's deductible. You have to prove that you actually meet one of those exceptions. There's thousands of them, okay? Exceptions to that law, business expenses being one of them, right? But you have to prove that you meet that exemption. But let me give you an example, okay? So you're headed to a conference. Let's say you're headed to a conference as a student and you're headed to a conference that is not in your field of endeavor, okay? It's some other field. But it's something that you want to learn about. Okay, well, that's not deductible. That's a personal expense, right? But if you did it in your field of endeavor, that's deductible. Well, so you have to prove that it's in your field of endeavor, that it actually is a business expense, that you're going to make money from this. It's not just for your better education. So, those are the types of things you have to look at. You go, wait a minute, I have to prove it's deductible.
So let's use this as an example. And first of all, I just want to state, maybe to summarize what you said and make sure I'm hearing it right, that in typical law, in typical matters of citizen versus government, the burden of proof is on the accuser or the prosecutor. But in taxes, the burden of proof is on the accused, is basically what you're saying.
Exactly. Because you are actually the one, you're proving that you're an exception to the rule.
Because you're challenging the law. The law is not challenging you.
Exactly. The law says it's not deductible.
Right.
Unless you can prove that it is. And that's what it says. So those two rules really are kind of the crux of the tax law. If you understand those two rules, now the rest of it is just looking at, okay, so what income isn't taxable? What are those exceptions? And what expenses are deductible? What are those exceptions?
So, okay, so I'll use myself as an example. I have, I'm invested in a company that's based in the United Kingdom, and they're doing oil fields, you know, research out in a, you know, some foreign land. And I want to go attend, well, a shareholder conference would be very explicit, but let's say I want to just go attend a session about, you know, drilling and, you know, oil field engineering, because I want to learn more to be able to do my own diagnosis of the seismic results and assess value for myself as an investor. But it's a, there's sort of a indirect connection there that I would have to prove or potentially explain. How would I go about making sure from the get-go that my trip to said conference is contextualized so that I don't have a million questions to answer later that get me in hot water?
Well, the next step is, okay, if it could be deductible, how would it be deductible? So I'll give you, for your example, I'll give you two alternatives. Let's say that you had a business in the oil industry. So you actually had your own business in the oil industry. Sure. Okay. I have clients that have businesses in the oil industry. And then you were going to go to that conference, or you were going to go to that, go see that. That would be clearly a business expense. Okay. Right. So that's a business expense. But now you're talking about, I'm an investor. Now there are deductions for investment expenses, but they're different than business expenses. So we actually have a weird thing going on in the tax law right now in the US, where most investment expenses, while they are quote unquote deductible, there's no place on your tax return to deduct them.
Hmm. Did they just, there used to be, and they just removed?
There used to be. And in the 2017 Act, they took that away. So they just took away the where to deduct it. They didn't take away that by definition it's deductible, but there's no place to deduct it. So by conclusion, it's not deductible. Okay. So there are other things you do. So if I can't deduct it, can I just add it to the cost of the investment? Is it really a kind of a carrying cost, right? Like interest.
And then does it become
part? And then of when you sold it, then it would become cost basis. So those are the types of that's the type of analysis that you would go to your CPA for and say, okay, here's my situation. Is there a way for me to, first of all, I'd rather deduct it now. I'd rather not wait. And right. If I can't deduct it now, could I add it to my basis, my cost basis, so that I can actually not pay less tax in the future when I sell that investment?
So, okay. I this is a case where I actually could turn this whole hour into my personal tax consulting. And I'm not going to do that, because now you've raised some actual real questions that are specific to me. But let's stick with what's more generally applicable here. Like, first of all, what do you make of the fact, like, I don't have to tell you that generally, there's a very perceived adversarial relationship with the IRS and with tax authorities in general. I mean, and that's that goes back to the Bible, I'd say. So, but like, what do you make of the fact that these, you know, forgive me, but these, I don't know if they're a-holes or just nincompoops that don't know what they're doing, that they removed a line from the form that's still supported by the law? Are they trying to game us?
No, actually, it was actually a revenue raiser. That, you know, you have to, if you give tax benefits like they did with bonus depreciation in 2017, you have to have it has to be paid for somewhere else, and that was a pay for. Okay, it was intentional. Yeah. But the reason they didn't take it out is because, of course, all of this 2017 tax law, with the exception of the corporate income tax decrease, all of it's temporary, right? It all expires in a couple of years. Actually, it expires in a couple of years. So they did it that way because it was easier to do it that way. So technically, technically it's not, but the advantage to that is because it's not technically non-deductible, I think you might have an argument to add it to your cost basis. I mean, I have to do research on that one, but I think there's an argument. So what I want to look at as a tax advisor is I want to understand what's the context of law? What are the concepts? And what I want to get to the entrepreneurs in tax-free wealth is understand enough so that you know, maybe I could deduct this. Is there something I could do? And then sit down with your tax advisor and say, hey, look, this is a big enough expense. It's going to cost me $10,000 to do this trip. I'd really like it to be deductible. You know, take an hour and do some research. And is there an argument for that? And where would I deduct it? How would I deduct or how would I add it to my cost basis? So that's the idea. Because the reality is that I can't reduce your taxes. What I can do is tell you what you need to do to reduce your taxes. And then I can report it on your tax return in the right way so that it actually works the way we want it to work.
So, okay, maybe this is just me wanting to throw a little tantrum and move on. But like for the IRS to say, well, we're not going to change the underlying law. We're just going to close the portal that allows you to utilize the underlying law. That's like them saying, well, we're not taking away free speech. We're just going to cut the phone lines of people when we don't like what they say.
It's kind of like that. But it kind of is like that. Only it wasn't the IRS who did that. It was Congress. So that's another thing to recognize is that there's two tax bodies here. There's Congress, and normally Congress giveth and the IRS taketh away. That's kind of the way to look at it. Going to your Bible analogy, the IRS giveth, Congress taketh. I mean, the Congress giveth, the IRS taketh away. In this case, Congress took it away. Okay, it wasn't the IRS. So honestly, you can't blame the IRS for that. That is Congress that did that. IRS is the administrators, and Congress, they're the ones who make the law. So Congress did make that law. There were a lot of laws that were benefits. And so every time there's a tax law change, there's winners and losers. Every time there's a tax law change, there's winners and losers. And so in 2017, employees were losers. And business owners and real estate investors were winners.
Okay.
They were the winners, but employees were losers. Think about during COVID, everybody worked from home during COVID. Nobody went to the office, or very few people went to the office. Well, if you were an employee working from home, you got no tax benefit for working from home. But if you were a business owner, you did. You got to take your home office deduction. So that's clearly an incentive to be a business owner. And that is actually the incentive. It's on purpose.
So, okay, let's go there. I mean, we were going through the core principles, you know, all income is taxable unless we say it isn't. Basically, nothing is deductible unless we agree that it is. Is there a next one that's essentially, and I think, you know, if I remember back to my original reading of Robert Kiyosaki, it was like, he's like, guys, the tax law is actually telling you to own businesses and invest in real estate. Is that pretty close to a first principle of tax law, is like own businesses and invest in capital assets?
So here's the way I like to put it. Anybody who ever remembers their first paycheck remembers that pay stub, and they're going, who the hell is this FICA person? They're taking all my money. And what's this withholding? That's why am I not getting my paycheck? I thought I was getting paid $10 an hour. Looks to me like I'm only getting paid $7 an hour. What the heck? Well, what you realize pretty quick is you got a partner in your business or your job, and that partner is the government. And you don't get to choose whether they're your partner. What you do get to choose is what kind of partner you are. So you get to choose, am I a silent partner with the government? And I just go ahead and pay my taxes and put my head in the sand and just say, okay, I'm just going to pay my tax. I don't want to deal with it. Like most people who frankly invest in the stock market do, right, with ETFs and mutual funds. Or am I going to be an active partner with the government and invest the way they want me to invest? So how would, you know, what does the government want to have happen that they would like private industry to do for them or in partnership with them? Well, first of all, they'd like to create jobs. That's why business is, every country incentivizes business. Every country on earth incentivizes business in their tax law. Next, do I need, we need housing built and we need commercial buildings built, you know, to house those businesses for the jobs. Right. So, and we need the warehouses and the, you know, the industrial and all of those things. So retail shops. So what we're going to do is we're going to incentivize real estate, but you can't invest in a business that invests in the real estate. You have to invest in real estate directly. Okay. They want you to actually invest in real estate. They don't want you to invest in a stock. That's just a derivative. Then the company that's doing the real estate investing, they get the benefit, not the investor.
And that's so, because the government would view that essentially as double dipping. Hey, we're already
Exactly. Tax breaks for the company. That's exactly what it would be. That's exactly what it'd be because the company is already getting the tax benefit for it. Right. And so if the investor also got a tax benefit, that would exactly be right. That'd be double dipping. And really you're just buying a derivative when you buy a stock, right? That's right, just a derivative. But if you invest directly in, so the government wants housing built, therefore there are tax deductions for building housing. They want, what else they want? Well, they want energy. So we have, in the law right now, we have huge incentives for both fossil fuel energy as well development, as well as renewable energy development. And the incentives in renewable energy are greater than they are in the fossil fuel, but they're still great in both places. But again, you can't invest in Exxon and get that deduction because Exxon gets the deduction, right? You don't. And then the other one that's a really big one would be agriculture, because government wants food produced. Well, the government doesn't want to be in the business producing food. And frankly, they should stay out of that business because they're very bad at it. So we're going to let private industry produce the food. Well, agriculture actually has the best tax benefits of any type of investing is agriculture.
When you hear a lot about the government subsidizing agriculture, this is one of the ways is...
For sure.
That is through tax, but that's not the only, I mean, there also are overt subsidies.
Oh yeah.
They buy crops.
Obviously they have overt subsidies
price
as well.
All
of that stuff. There's a lot of subsidies and you can look at tax incentives as subsidies. They are, they're a fairly efficient subsidy, for two reasons. One is, the tax law is actually much more efficient than people give it credit for. That's why during COVID, those checks that went out to people, the $1,400 checks, $1,000 checks, et cetera, they went out as through the IRS because the IRS was was already set up to administer something like that. And so these incentives actually are pretty efficient in the tax law. The other thing is that even the government knows that people don't like paying taxes. They don't. They're okay with other people paying taxes. That's why there's this whole tax the rich thing going on, right? Right. I'm okay with somebody else paying tax. Just don't tax me, right? Which we can talk about that if you want, because there's actually some news on that one. But because of that emotional part of not paying taxes, people will do things for a tax incentive they might not do for a direct subsidy.
Interesting.
So they
dollar
for dollar. Because it's such an emotional word. Tax is such an emotional word that people, I remember a client early in my career and he would spend $2 to save a dollar of tax. Yeah. He would absolutely spend $2 to save a dollar of tax. He just hated paying taxes.
Yeah. I mean, I can relate. I will say that's one of the most maddening parts of, I used to be broke. I guess the only great thing about that was I never paid any taxes. Now I'm not broke anymore. And it's, you know, I get it. But okay. So, but I actually love this concept. And this was, you know, when you were talking about understanding the principles, and you know, you can leave the details to the professionals. I thought about my own life and how, even when I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I was a jazz musician back when I read it. Like I didn't have a lot of money, but actually at the time credit was a little easier to come by. And I did what I could do to kind of get my hands on some rental properties. And, you know, I've built that portfolio, but I have properties now that I got 20 years ago when I didn't really have a clue what I was doing, but just because I understood the one basic principle of the government wants you to own real estate. And Robert writes this, he wrote this in Rich Dad, Poor Dad, that one of the last responsibilities the government is ever going to want for itself is to have to house its citizens. And so it'll always incentivize you to do it before it chooses to do it itself. And on that, like, I mean, I read that 25 years ago and it landed with me. And on that basis, I started buying properties that now I didn't know nearly enough to know how it was going to work or even why, but my tax situation is just generally better than it would be otherwise if I had invested in other things. So I do appreciate that. Jobs, real estate, energy, agriculture. What are the other kind of biggies in that category?
Within business is research and development. So that's actually a kind of a subset of business. But okay. That would be one of the big ones is you're doing, innovation.
Innovation, technology, right? So you're actually giving the government probably more credit than I typically do for being self-aware enough to at least have some sense of a bounded capability. I mean, I think of the government as like this Leviathan that just wants to grow, but you're saying it actually knows it's not great at certain things.
Well, it seems less and less that way. I mean, you look at that project down in Southern California where it's costing over $600,000 per unit to house homeless. And I'm going, but there are, if you look at what's done, there's private companies who are doing it for like $100,000 per unit, right? So the private sector is more efficient than the government sector. It always has. I mean, look at Elon Musk, right? Elon Musk SpaceX. is landing a rocket. He figured out how to land a rocket on a pad in the ocean. Well, why did he figure out how to do that? Because that's the only way to make a profit doing rocket launches. Well, the government doesn't need to make a profit. So they're not considering things like, could I reuse the rocket? Because the problem with one of the issues with people with the government, and it's not true all the way through, but it's true with a lot of people in the government, is that it's really easy to spend somebody else's money.
Yeah.
And they have these budgets. And not only that, if they don't spend the budget, they get a lower budget the next year, which is a terrible, terrible way to administer this. But and so what happens is they become less and less efficient. Plus, they have to kind of grease the skids along the way. I mean, you look at, they have to have, even look at the renewable energy incentives. If you pay union wages, you get five times the tax credit as if you pay non-union wages on a solar energy project. You get five times the credit if you pay union wages and follow union rules. Now you don't have to, they couldn't force you to use union people. That would be illegal. That would be unconstitutional. But they can say you have to follow all these rules. And by the way, they just exactly match what the union requires.
Hey there, it's Jeff. So real quick, I want to let you know about my text message community. I use text messages to provide unique value to the Unlock Your Potential community. These texts could just be random thoughts. It could be letting you be the first to know about an event I'm planning, maybe giving an update on a special I'm running or some free training that I host for my community. Anyway, just shoot me a text to get subscribed to the list. The number is 702-996-3926. Again, that is 702-996-3926. Let's get back to the podcast. Yeah. And so in effect, they can. I mean, I love that we're getting into perverse incentives, although that's a whole other podcast, right? We could tear the government apart. But basically what you're saying is they can't force you to do a thing, but they can so penalize you for doing other things that are not the thing that effectively they're forcing you to do the thing.
Yeah. What they're doing is providing just a smaller incentive. So the reality is that if you're a solar project, then these are projects over $1 million. But if you got a major solar project, you need that 30% credit. You don't want a 6% credit because in order to make it work, you need the 30% credit because solar's not particularly efficient right now.
Well, and because the market is organized around that incentive is built into the pricing model of that market.
Totally. Look at what happened when in August of 2022, when they announced the vehicle tax credit, the $7,500 tax credit, right, was going to be renewed. All the car manufacturers raised the price of electric vehicles $7,000 to $8,000. Shocking. I mean, it was like immediate. It was just like, are you kidding me? I mean, how is it that this saves anybody any money? But it still works. And the reason is because, let's say I've got a $30,000 car versus a $40,000 car, but I get a $10,000 credit, okay, on the $40,000 car. I am frankly more likely to buy the $40,000 car with the $10,000 credit than the $30,000 car without the credit.
Is that because of what you said about people having emotions attached to taxes?
For sure.
And savings?
Absolutely.
It's just marketing psychology, basically.
It's just marketing psychology. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, which I'll just say this, and we don't have to veer off onto this course, but in general, I believe one of the greatest travesties in the modern world is a basic, and this would be a very Kiyosaki thing to say, is a basic lack of financial and economic competence, just as a across the population as a like a default. I mean, we should all understand things like we're talking about, how, like, you know, an incentive can be really a marketing trick because of how it's baked into the pricing across the you know, an economy. That should be as natural to us as knowing that, like, I want to, you know, date a girl when I'm 16. Like, it just should be known, and it's not.
Well, it's like, okay, so President Biden in his last State of the Union address talking about what he calls shrinkflation, which I've called sizeflation for years. But this idea that you're getting a smaller unit for the same price. Well, why do they do that instead of just increasing the price? Because people are more comfortable with a smaller amount and the same price than they are with a bigger price, even though the price per ounce may be exactly the same either way.
Or higher even.
Right.
They can hide it. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. But I thought it was funny that he used Snickers bars as an example. I'm going, we could use smaller Snickers bars, quite frankly. Look at the size of our population.
Right. So, right. That's funny.
Not a bad thing.
Okay. So I want to, in the last, I'm keeping an eye on the time here, thinking like totally in context of the audience, right? So we talked a little before the show. Audience of the show tends to be very entrepreneurial. A lot of them are in the middle of, you know, pretty seismic life changes that sometimes involve starting or leaning into a business from the standpoint of, you know, let's say transforming it from a hobby to a real endeavor, right? Like they're gonna really do it now. And so for that person who, you know, frankly is not at the point where maybe they're ready to hire your firm to come in and plan for them, but they're starting to think entrepreneurially, more like a business owner or investor type. You know, I'm picturing Robert's quadrants. What are some of the concepts they can ground to? I feel like you've given us a huge one, which is that really the closer you can move yourself to the value center that's at the core of what society needs to function, jobs, real estate, energy, agriculture, innovation, that, like, you know, as a first principle, that's a good thing. What are some other good thing first principles that people can start to really embed in their psyches to not just change, you know, to change like how they think, not just what they do?
Well, I think a big one is to get over the idea that there are restrictions that you can't overcome. A true entrepreneur never believes that, you know, what was the Ryan Holiday's book, The Obstacle is the Way, right? Yeah. So the obstacle is actually the opportunity. It's not the hindrance, it's the opportunity. And so, you know, I'll give you share a quick story. So several years ago, I was in Santiago, Chile with Robert, and we had a room of about 600 people. And there was the sponsor of the event was the Bentley Lamborghini dealer in Santiago. And on one side of the stage, off of one side of the stage was a Bentley, and off the other side was a Lamborghini. So it's a 2-day event. First day, Robert turns to me and he says, Tom, I want you to teach him how to deduct a Bentley today. So I get up and I went through these four tests, right? And said, this is how you deduct it. So at lunchtime, a tax attorney from Santiago came up to me and he said, Tom, that's really great. I just want you to know you can't do that in Chile because cars are considered a luxury and luxuries aren't deductible. I said, okay, it's good to know. Thank you. And that evening, I'm sharing the story with Robert and the other speakers, and Robert just kind of nods his head and smiles. Next morning, we're about to go on stage, and he says, Tom, today, you're going to teach them how to deduct a Bentley legally in Chile. And I'm going, okay. I'm going, yeah, I've learned. Always trust the process. Just trust it, right? It'll work. And even though I had no reason to disbelieve this person, and I'm sure that was the law, we got up, Robert and I got up, and we actually showed a different way to look at it of how to deduct the cost of a Bentley in Chile. And after the event, the same tax attorney came up to me and said, I never would have thought of doing it that way. It would absolutely work. So I think that's the most important thing for budding entrepreneurs to realize is that there is always a way. And I used to think there were some things that just aren't deductible, like a cruise. It's not deductible. You know, entertainment, mm-hmm. It's not deductible. That's limited thinking. Change the way you think, change the mindset. And then the other challenge is, on the flip side, you have to have an advisor who actually thinks that way as well. And that is the biggest challenge that we run into, because most CPAs, most even so-called tax planners, they do not understand that they've got to think differently. They can't just look at the tax law as a linear equation. It's a nonlinear equation. And so you've got to look at how it interacts, how the laws interact with each other and how the investments interact with each other. How, for example, give you a simple example. I put solar on my own house. I get a 30% tax credit. I put it on a rental property. I get a 30% tax credit and a 65% deduction. That's just a different thought process. In other words, if I do it for somebody else's house, I get a better tax deduction than if I do it for my house. Because it's now a rental property, now it's business. Now I get to take the depreciation deduction, which I don't get to do on my own. Okay, but that's the type of thought process that not only does the entrepreneur have to have, but their advisor has to have. That's actually why we are building, why we have a franchise of firms, because we have firms that'll handle the brand new entrepreneurs just starting out, all the way up to my firm that handles the Robert Kiyosakis of the world. So with a franchise, you can do that. With a single firm, you cannot. So that's actually why we developed a franchise.
Okay. So I you know, in entrepreneurial circles, one of the things we talk about and you know, preach is to train yourself to start asking how, not if.
Exactly.
Another way of saying it, you know, well, T. Harbecker. Oh, go ahead.
So in the tax context, that would be, don't ask, is it deductible, but ask, how do I make it deductible?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I thank you. I was expecting a principle that was just specific to tax, but that's a bigger, deeper one. Any others that come to mind for the person listening who's trying to, you know, I still, it's funny. I mean, tell me if you see it the same way, but I feel like here we are almost 30 years after the publication of Rich Dad Poor Dad, and the world is continually vindicating and validating what Robert was saying back then.
Oh, for sure. And you know, there are people who are entrepreneurial and they want to be in control of their life. They want to be in control of their own success. They want to be in control of their wealth. They want to be in control. And then there are other people that want to give up control. And so the people who want to give up control, they should be employees, right? With a single client, by the way. That an employee is just somebody with a single client. That's right. All an employee is, right? Very risky proposition to have one client. But they want to give that up. Go put your money into an S&P 500 ETF. Okay, great. I don't have to worry about it. I'm just going to let the market do its thing and I don't care. Right. So that's one choice. But I think that it's the financial education is what you're doing on this podcast. Once you have the education, you get a choice. And the goal for me as an advisor and as a teacher is to help people understand that there's a choice. And if we don't know, we can't have a choice. And I think what Rich Dad Poor Dad has done for millions and millions of people is they didn't know there was a choice. And now they see there's a choice. I can take control of my life, or I can let other people control my life. It's my choice. Okay. But if you're going to take control of your life, here's the things you have to do, right? The Rich Dad Poor Dad is just this kind of the start of it. And then you've got to go into things like tax-free wealth and what you do. And, you know, there's, seminars and conferences and all this other education, because you don't want to do something without being knowledgeable about it. Otherwise, that's a pretty risky proposition.
So tell us about, you obviously have the book behind you there, Tax-Free Wealth. Tell us about that book and that concept. And then obviously, as we head to the end, tell us how we can get it and get to know you better too.
Yeah. So Tax-Free Wealth has been the number one bestseller. In fact, Entrepreneur Magazine just made it their number one on their top 15 tax planning books, which was great to see. It's a really simple book to read on how the tax law, the truth about taxes. That's what it is. How does the tax law actually work? And there's lots of simple things in there. You know, we could talk about the Augusta rule, that, you know, rent your house for 14 days and not pay tax. We could talk about, paying your children and having your children work in your business. I mean, there's all those little things in there. So there's little tidbits throughout Tax-Free Wealth. But the goal of Tax-Free Wealth is to help you understand, here's how the tax law works. And then chapter three, we talk about, here's how you find a good tax advisor. And we give you an easy button, which is just call Wealthability, and we have tax advisors. So that is the easy button. So if you don't want to go interviewing, you want to let me do the interviewing for your tax advisor, I'm happy. You know, I've done that. You know, we've actually built this franchise, and we actually called our franchisees from a bigger group that we'd been working with for 5 or 6 years. And we culled them down to this core franchise so that we could have the best of the best. And that's what you do.
Interesting. And so, yeah, it's funny. I mean, I obviously, I'm so active out in the world on the employee versus entrepreneur conversation and in a number of other ways. And I will state for the record, I'm not attached to how people make money. I'm very attached to people having freedom and control in their life.
Right. Exactly.
But I will say, I mean, I'm still just shocked at the generalized, and I don't mean this disparagingly, but the generalized ignorance out there. Like you say, I mean, and I'll even ask, maybe this is a philosophical note to end on, like, do you actually think there are people that really don't want control of their lives? Or have they just been brainwashed to the idea that it's either not possible or it's so onerous to try to get control that you have to turn your entire life into this, you know, fight?
You know, I would answer that by, if you think about a three-year-old and you ask them what they want to be when they grow up, they're just as likely to say a tiger as they are to say a fireman or a policeman, right? Something like that. But they could say, I want to be a tiger, because they don't have boundaries. They dream, and they don't have boundaries on those dreams. What we do from 3 to 18, or 3 right now, 3 to 24, is we put more and more boundaries on them. We say, this is how you should think. This is what you should be doing. You should get a job. You should buy, buy a house, get married, have kids, get a job, you know, all those things, right? I think we need to actually unlearn a lot of what we've learned and start to dream again. What I love about entrepreneurs, a true entrepreneur is a dreamer. And they're a dreamer with action. And that's really, to me, the definition of an entrepreneur. It's a dreamer who actually acts on that dream, doesn't just dream it, right? It's not just a wish. So that's what I think is great about entrepreneurs. I think that's why, that's what causes me to want to work solely with entrepreneurs. If somebody comes to me as an employee and says, I want you to do my taxes, I'm going to say, we're probably not the right place. If you're not planning to take control of your money and to actually take control of how you invest and take control of your life, we're probably not a good fit.
That's interesting. Is it always as binary as that? I mean, I assume there are employees that are saying, yeah, but I have a very entrepreneurial mindset. I'm trying to build skills and values so that I can increase income in the context of employment. and I'm funneling some of that money into something else to like, is it as binary as that,
if their idea of funneling money into something else, it's so two questions that any advisor, tax advisor should be asking you. First is, how do you make your money? That's what we were just talking about. But the second is, what are you going to do with your money? Which is what you just alluded to. And what you're going to do with your money, that question has a bigger impact on your future taxes than how you make your money. Mm. And I've heard tax planners, so-called tax planners, tax advisors, ask the question, how do you make your money? And they'll get you set up so you pay less tax. But they never ask the question, the more important question, which is, what are you going to do with your money? Because even as an employee, you know, it's the cash flow quadrant you were talking about earlier in Robert's second book, Cash Flow Quadrant. Well, there's one of the quadrants is investor, right? So you can be an employee and an investor, but that means that you're an active investor, not a passive investor. And that means you're actually investing in hard assets, you know, the big five we were talking about. And you invest in those assets, then you get big tax breaks with it.
Awesome. Okay. How can the world go meet you and learn more and potentially retain you if it's appropriate?
Really simple, wealthability.com. And you're probably not going to retain me. I take like two clients a year and I charge a ridiculous amount of money for it. So, you don't need me.
But your network. Okay? I mean, you have a network.
Yeah. We have literally a franchise. I mean, this is actually a Wealthability franchise. And so we actually have people that are completely, I've been training them for years already. They are all, they understand tax-free wealth. They ask me questions if they have a question. So you actually indirectly have some access to me. And that way we can serve more people at a much broader segment of the entrepreneurial population.
Awesome. Wealthability.com. We'll make sure that and any other relevant links are in the show notes. Tom, thank you so much for your time. This has been enlightening and, don't take this the wrong way, perhaps a surprisingly amount of fun.
As I like it. It should be fun. It should be fun, easy, and understandable. Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah. No, wonderful. Thanks for being here. And as always, to you viewers and listeners, you are the best part of the show. Why we do it every time. So glad we got this time together. Catch you on the next one. Take care.
Hey, it's Jeff here. So if you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast each week, please consider leaving us a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that our work is reaching people and it helps us grow our audience. In fact, your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, checks out the podcast, and unlocks their potential, levels up their entire quality of life. So thank you again so much for your support and for listening, and especially if you like or share or leave us a review. Thank you in general for just helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential and going out and making the world and your world a better place.